Welcome to the Sizzle Podcast. I am Dr. Joe Taylor. In every one of our episodes, I bring my psychological lens along, and the guests and I have a warm conversation about a hot topic. Today's episode is with Johnny Walker. Johnny is an educational consultant, an author, and a mythology teacher. And I'm so interested to talk with Johnny because of the exciting and innovative way that he teaches, but also the focus he has on teaching mythology, which is not something I had access to in school myself.
I'm enjoying at the moment going into like Norse mythology. I don't want to like make the connection that just because my beard is slightly ginger that I'm like claiming some sort of like Nordic ancestry. But if I am going to do that, I think I've got Nordic ancestry.
And I'm really curious to hear a bit more about the link between teaching and writing and how they might influence each other. So let's get into it. Johnny, hello. It's so nice to be able to speak with you. And it might be nice for me just to provide a bit of context for how I came across you, because we haven't met. I actually feel like I have a sense of your personality. This is one of the dangers of social media, maybe. But some of your videos about mythology and teaching that I've seen online just have such energy, and they really put across a sense of expertise and a sense of, I really want you to be interested in this too. And so I just was really keen to talk to you as an educator and to hear about your journey, and also just to think a little bit about mythology, because that's something that I've had quite an up and down relationship with as a person. And I was thinking about this in advance of our conversation, and I was thinking, I think as a young child, I was interested in things of the past, maybe the Romans or Greek gods or the Egyptians. And then in secondary school, and probably my whole of my 20s, there was a massive gap, and I had no exposure or interest. And then in my 30s, it's coming back around. It feels like it's really coming back around. And I just thought, what an opportunity to have someone whose work is in this area, and not only that, whose work is around engaging children on this topic. So that's my like blurb intro, but I'd love to hear a bit about you, your work, and maybe your journey as an educator.
Sure. Well, thank you as well for getting me on as well. Like I ruin a lot of parties when I'm just talking about the Iliad and just forcing every conversation back to my own little niche interests. So it's nice that we've got like a protected space to do that. In terms of mythology specifically, my experience was very similar to yours. So as a kid, I was really, really obsessed with it. And, you know, in my mind, and from what I've seen teaching mythology to kids online, there does seem to be something about the age of like 8, 9, 10, that there's something about that age and where a child's development is, that mythology seems to do something different. You know, it seems to be one of the few accessible ways in which they can think about themselves, maybe at like one degree of separation. So I remember myself, you know, as a child reading some of these myths, like reading Icarus and just experiencing it, not like the way that I'd read other stories that I liked. So it's been funny, similarly to you, I kind of didn't have much exposure to it at all in secondary, fell out of love with it. Had like a small baller phase when I tried to be a sporty boy and like push the books away. And then, yeah, later on, I would say like as I'd started teaching mid-20s, it just started to kind of come back. And, you know, from my own university education as well, I'd remember several conversations we'd be having in supervisions where other students would be dropping in loads of like mythological analogies and like Iliad references. And I would sit there, you know, doing like the sort of gormless, like, yes. But the references were going above my head. I knew enough to know what I was missing, but I didn't know what it was. So there was a kind of sense of frustration, which led me to get really into the Iliad in my late 20s. I think it was probably as I was moving into school leadership. I don't know how much it's linked. I don't want to take too many leaderships from mythology, because it's probably, it would explain why I wasn't very good as a school leader, perhaps, if I had like Agamemnon in my head. But then something around, I would say maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago, I just got really into it again. And through lockdown, it was just the strangest of pivots. Like, I'm talking to you now from inside my like garden shed thing, which is where I spent the large part of lockdown teaching mythology on the internet on this online platform called OutSchool. So it just gave me the opportunity to have, I'd say like 2.5 years of just immersing in Greek mythology to a really obsessive level. And then that's led to where I'm at now. So, I'm a teacher. So I've been a teacher since 2011. So I did teach first in the first full cohort of primary teachers in 2011, was placed in a school in East London. And I've not really strayed from there at all. So I still work with that school. But then since 2019, I've been working for myself. So like doing projects between schools, mostly East London schools. And now I'm in this position where I work for myself and I'm kind of a teacher who writes and a writer who teaches. And I'm finding that there's a really nice like symbiosis between the two of them. I'm teaching writing to children, and it's helping me when I'm doing my own writing. But likewise, my interactions with the kids are developing my writing. It's just, I'm in an interesting place.
Yeah, that really resonates with me. I'm an applied psychologist, and there's a real sense of what I read and learn about is then shaped by how I'm working with families and children and professionals in school. So I really love that kind of circular nature of development that you described. I think there are so many threads I'd love to pick up on. The first I have to ask is just for you to give a kind of potted explanation of the Iliad, because you mentioned it 3 times and I feel like it's a familiar, famous story. And I couldn't give you much more than that. I'd love to hear a bit more, but also this could be a nice example of just the kind of the, maybe it goes back to your experience of seminars when you're hearing people mention these things, these cultural reference points, and you're like, I'm grasping at that. It's like, I know it's a thing. I know it has this importance historically, but I can't quite kind of get to it. So yeah, what is the Iliad, and like, where does it fall in the kind of timeline / geocultural landscape of mythology?
Sure. So the Iliad itself then is an epic poem which tells of one small part of the Trojan War. I think what's really fascinating about it is how much it is grounded in the individual relationships between the people who are involved. So largely it's about the rivalry between Agamemnon, who is the leader of the Greek army, and Achilles, who is this kind of fabled, demigod, lots of prophecy about him that he's going to achieve all of these amazing things. So at the same time as it being intensely and obviously historical, there's something incredibly timeless about the fact that so much of it is tied in ideas of like violence and aggression, about ego, ambition. For me specifically, all of my engagement with the Iliad, for myself as a reader, has been always through the lens of a teacher as well. So because I came at it in this kind of interesting way, like my academic background is in social sciences. So I studied like politics, sociology, psychology, social anthropology and stuff. And then went into primary school teaching. But there's still a part of me that wants to kind of shoehorn a social sciencey kind of approach into what we do in primary. And I think as well, because for me, there was that sense that I wouldn't call it betrayal. I think maybe I spend so much time reading myths, I go to extreme language like betrayal very easily. But I was definitely very frustrated that it felt like I'd got to uni, and maybe because of my own schooling, there was just huge things that I'd missed out on, cultural things. I'm sure I had cultural experiences that others didn't have, which are valued, you know, I value myself. Like, it's not just that there's one form of good culture to have, and if you have it, great. If you don't, you don't. But I did feel like that would have been something that would be good for me to know. So in the way that I approach the Iliad and the way that I think about it, it's always through, like, how can I hook children into it in a way that they get as much from it as possible. So the way that I use the Iliad is to situate it in, like, the story of the whole of mythology, really. So when I teach the Iliad project as, like, a 6 sessions working with a group of kids, we'll start with the beginning of time. We'll have kids, like, recreating Uranos and Gaia, so, like, the heavens and the earth emerging out of chaos. And, like, we'll see how Cronus is born, and Cronus, you know, devours his babies who are, like, Poseidon. And, you know, we do all of this stuff, and the kids experience it as, like, this is, like, the weirdest lesson. Who is this weird guy coming in doing this odd, like, drama stuff with us? But as we go from that, we kind of tiptoe into the details of the Iliad. So we look at the idea of prophecy right from the very first session. And then through that, we look at the prophecies about Achilles, which then leads us into the whole events of the Iliad as well. So the way that I teach it has become this strange mix of academic and pastoral. So what I try to do is all the kids who will take part will end up with a really good knowledge of this, you know, culturally interesting story. But also it can be, again, I would say, like, a lens. Like, I've always found that mythology is a really good lens through which I can look at my own values and thoughts. And I try to do that with the kids as well. So as an example, there's, you know, a point in the lead up to the Trojan War. So this isn't actually in the Iliad itself as a poem, but it's one of the reasons why the war happens. There's this scene with the apple of discord. So the goddess of chaos, Eris, arrives with a golden apple, gives it to this guy at the wedding called Peleus. Peleus has to choose who to give this apple to. And on the apple, it says Callisti. And Callisti means, like, for the most beautiful one, the most beautiful woman. So he has to choose between giving it to his new wife, because it is his own wedding that this is happening at. But then Hera would like the apple, the goddess of, in the way I talk about it with the kids, that she represents kind of power. Athena would like the apple, representing wisdom. And Aphrodite would like the apple, representing beauty. So at the same time as building that as a, you know, as the academic storytelling of it, what we then do is pause the story, and then we talk about those concepts. So it gives us a great contextualized opportunity to talk with the kids about, what does it mean to be powerful? What does power look like for a 10-year-old? Do you feel like you have enough power in whatever way you define that? Same with wisdom. Like, interestingly for me, I presume that wisdom would be one that would be taken for granted. But the children they don't encounter the word wisdom, it seems. You know, they know about knowledge and smartness and intelligence, but wisdom is always one that's really good to talk about. And beauty they reject. So they say, they're like, ugh, because they see beauty as, like, vanity, or as somehow, like, shameful to talk about. So just by introducing that one particular mythological scene, it allows each kid, through, like, personal little writing things that they do, I give them, like, a little workbook, but also through discussion, to then go into these huge universal conversations around, you know, what would, if you could only choose one, in the same way that Paris eventually has to choose between Hera, Athena, and Aphrodite, if you had to choose just power, just wisdom, or just beauty, which one would give you the life closest to the life that you would want?
So, I mean, I have to ask, which does Paris go for?
So Paris goes for beauty. So in the end, the three goddesses offer different deals. And Aphrodite's deal is that she will ensure that Paris has the love of the most beautiful woman in the world, that he loves her, that she will love him. And of course, the big drama that then leads to the Trojan War is that the most beautiful woman in the world is already married to somebody else. And that leads to wife stealing and retribution and all sorts of other happy stories to share with 9-year-olds.
You know what? Like I've seen the Brad Pitt Troy film, and I feel like actually the wedding and the story that you described, that prequel, is almost more interesting. And you know, like I think as a psychologist, like especially a child psychologist, there's a real theme in my work of trying to find or understand and share the wisdom of children to adults. And this is my uneducated take on Greek mythology, or the way, or even just noticing the way that you talked about the Iliad, that it seems like that there are some kind of timeless truths or archetypes in there that people use to make sense of the world around them, even if that's, you know, thousands of years later. And I'm curious to know whether you see children plucking out different types of wisdom from that, or whether there are certain aspects that seem to resonate with children.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. And for me as a teacher, this has probably been one of the biggest changes in my own pedagogy. I would say, like, maybe for the first 5 or 6 years of my teaching, I was like a case study in like that sort of butterfly mindedness. So I would like flit from one thing to another. I'd teach each lesson once, enjoy that. The novelty of everything was what kept me feeling really fresh and energized. But it's through doing this kind of work, and I would say teaching poetry as well, I get a similar kind of like learning vibe when I'm teaching poetry. The kind of fascination becomes less about the content itself, but more about the different ways that when I'm teaching the same lesson and phrasing it in similar ways, why is it and how is it that different children respond in so many different ways? So, you know, to answer your question, I'm thinking of one school in which, you know, it's just, obviously I won't name schools, but it's a school that is, as a community, just riven by gang violence. And based on where it is, it's really isolated. Like, it's inner London, but, you know, as you'll know, like, certain parts of certain boroughs are just like little pockets, like they're just a little world unto themselves. And when I was teaching the Iliad in that context, the children clicked with it in a very different way. So things that in some schools I've had to really go to length to articulate, you know, how, for example, if somebody is slighted on one family, it might lead to another family seeking revenge, and that might carry on for a really, really long time. I've taught it in some schools where they're like, yeah, but why? Because they don't even know the people who did it. Whereas in this one community, they were like, yeah, of course. So it's really interesting that it's not that I'm like traveling around and just like bludgeoning the students with like one particular interpretation of the story. Increasingly, what I'm finding is I'm going to go for lens again. I feel like all I'm doing increasingly is going around with this one particular lens and trying to help the children to see through it. And that lens becomes maybe the Iliad itself. And through that, they can look back at themselves as well. It's too much to talk. It's ruining the metaphor to say they're using the lens whilst looking at a mirror that I also give them, but they can like look at the Iliad as a way to reflect on themselves. And then for the teachers, I think that's often what's really fascinating too, is that they get to see a very different side of their children when I come in and work with them. And I try to do it as like a collaborative project. And when it works best, essentially the teachers and I, you know, we are teaming up, introducing discussions, going through the content, doing lots of like high energy, easily accessible drama as well, which kind of gets the buy-in for all of the children so that they see it as, this is a thing that I'm interested in. This is fun. This is weird. This is curious. I've got like, you know, prosthetic goat masks for when Zeus gets looked after by Amalthea. I've got like all of these immersive hooks. But with the teacher, what we can then do is, through the quality of our own teaching and the quality of our own listening, take it somewhere a lot deeper. And yeah, hopefully it does something beyond just tell them a story, but it gives them a space in which they can reflect upon themselves, which is sometimes lacking in school.
So, I mean, you're making me think of Donna Tartt's A Secret History. I don't know if you've read it. So it's a book. Spoiler alert, people, I'm going to tell you the whole plot. It's a book where a child in America goes to university and ends up learning from a charismatic tutor just from them doing a deep dive into classics. And actually, no spoilers, that's basically on the back. But what I thought was really, I mean, I love that book for so many reasons. But one of the reasons is that it does this really great job of giving you just enough taste of classics to make you feel like you get it and it's interesting, but weaving it into the lives of all the main characters. And listening to you, you made me think about the fact that in that book, there's this one wise professor who creates these learning environments that are very bespoke to the students, and it's very responsive depending on where they want to take the knowledge. And I'm just thinking about the amount of thought you put into creating your learning environments. And this might be a stretch, but I feel like it kind of reminds me of the Greeks, like Aristotle and Plato, and the way that they would do similar things with their students and help them think about who they want to be as people and the social context and all that kind of stuff. I don't know what you make of that. Is that me just like weaving some stuff together, or is that kind of something that resonates?
No, I think it does resonate. Like, charisma is a really interesting word as well. And it's a word that I sometimes, like, is sometimes mentioned when I'm teaching. And I have an immediate negative reaction to it, because it like puts you in mind of, like, you know, drink the Kool-Aid sort of charisma. But it's interesting when I think back to my own schooling and the teachers who had a real impact. There was one in particular who, without realizing it, you know, it's a very different context. He was an A-level teacher, but he really sticks in my mind as a teacher who managed to use his own charisma in a way that was really democratizing. And, you know, for him, he was a sociology teacher in a really, really low performing school, where sociology had a bad reputation. So he would often, you know, I mean, he would feel blessed to have them. But it would be perceived that he would be getting all the students who couldn't do all the other things, like English Lit or whatever. But what he managed to do through his own charisma and his own passion for his subject was take students who hadn't necessarily found anything yet in their schooling that had really hooked them in. So maybe they were, you know, they're doing well enough that they can pass the tests, but they'd not found anything that gave them that spark. You know, I did well academically, but I hadn't really found a particular spark, I don't think, until it was kind of learning with him. Yeah, I don't know. I got sidetracked, because as soon as you said charisma, it kind of put me back in his canoe, which is a strange segue. But like, we did a trip in year 10, like before he was my teacher, we'd done like a water sports school trip thing. And yeah, maybe it was my own lack of popularity, but I was the one who was with the teacher in the canoe. So we had like an hour going down this river with this like charismatic guy who spoke to me and seemed to actually listen. And he was talking about stuff that I knew of, but I didn't know what it was. So he was saying things like Marxism, and I was like, I think that's probably a thing I would like. I don't know what it is, but it sounds interesting. So he was like talking about these isms and ologies, which I would then go on to love studying as a, you know, as a sociologist. So I don't know. I feel like I've had a few models, and you mentioned archetype earlier. I do feel like for me, there is a kind of archetypal teacher that on some level I kind of lean towards and gravitate towards, and it's through doing this kind of work that I can do that more, and I feel it gets more out of me as a teacher by being able to focus on my little niche interest. But then it's not really about the myths, even though everything is about the myths. I feel like teacher mythology is what allows me to teach children in this particular way.
Yeah, I'm so interested in the response you had to the word charisma, and it's making me think of the way that in the teaching profession, I think there's a narrative of don't rely on your personality, you know, have sound pedagogy. And it does frame this dichotomy of the charismatic, blagging teacher that relies on relationships and can't structure a lesson. And when you were talking about the canoe, I just heard connection and relationships. And I wonder if sometimes when we say charisma, we actually are noticing an adult who forms really strong connections with students. And I find myself talking a lot about the social and emotional processes of learning. Everyone always thinks about the cognitive processes of learning, you know, and actually the way that someone mediates a task or the ability to feel motivated or persevere when it's hard or whatever it is, you know, marshal your metacognitive strategies because you feel safe. All of these things are really part of the process. And I'm interested in what the education sector can do in terms of setting up this this shade against the word charisma. That's just something I think I noticed listening to you, and it made me think about pedagogy generally, because I think that you put a lot of thought into how you teach, and I'm interested, hot take, the difference between working online and in person, because this is something that psychologists and lots of educators are wrestling with at the moment. But I'm wondering what kinds of differences you notice and some of the pros and cons that you have in mind.
This is very fresh for me at the moment as well. Like at the moment my work is split, so I spend maybe about 10 hours a week teaching kids online, and that's, again, it's teaching Greek mythology. And then obviously now we're in like the sort of dregs of summer, so my teaching in schools has diminished, but usually I teach maybe 2 or 3 days in school as well. So I'm in both camps. Maybe if I start by saying about what this thing called OutSchool is. So in like February 2021, I'd gone fully freelance and was working for myself for a few months, and then lockdown hit. So I did like different things, went in, like volunteered and did like the key worker stuff in one of the schools. But I was looking for something that was a bit more sustained. And then this targeted advert came up for this thing called OutSchool, where you can make your own curriculum content. You can teach whatever you want. It's kind of high risk because it's a marketplace model. So you need to get your name out there and build up a bit of a sort of brand and everything. But I just thought, yeah, let's give this a go. And I had not done anything like that before. I started teaching online, and it was a truly global program, because obviously, well, you know, when it was our lockdown, it was most of the world's lockdown. So there were kids worldwide who were logging onto this platform, and they were like, oh, like, you know, what's this class here? So I started off trying to teach poetry, which I found really difficult to do online. It just didn't flow very easily. But as soon as I was like, you know what, there was this one thing I was really obsessed with as a child, mythology, I started teaching that. And then from that point on, it's been like a huge part of all of my work. And bizarrely, I feel like teaching online has started to shape the way that I teach in person. And I always expected it to be the other way around. Like things that I've learned from teaching online is that the connection that you make can be just as real. And that I came to recognize that because it's small group, and even maybe something about the fact that when it is mediated upon a screen and you've got the learner's faces right there, I was feeling as if I was becoming much more immediately perceptive to the impact that my words were having. So I could, you know, I've got 12 faces on a screen, and if I've phrased something in a slightly like weird way, or I've like gone on and I've lost the point, I'm noticing when they're starting to glaze over. Hopefully it doesn't happen quite to that extent that often. But I was starting to notice that. And also, with a lot of the kids that I was teaching online for mythology, they had chosen mythology, but they felt like mythology had chosen them in a way. Like, it was a lot of kids who were worldwide, maybe like school refusers. A lot of the kids who found mythology lessons online are kids who, maybe struggled with literacy, or they've had very negative experiences in school and have now fully moved to homeschool. So as well as there being some kids who were just signed off for lockdown, it just exposed me to a much wider group of students with a really broad range of need. So suddenly from having 30 kids where you might have, the more you know about your classes, the more you're likely to recognize, the pronounced needs that are everywhere. But in a class of 30, you tend to have maybe 4 or 5 kids who there's a lot of extra stuff going on that you need to be really mindful of. It kind of, my percentage has changed, and suddenly a lot of the students I were teaching were neurodivergent. A lot of the students I were teaching had had, a range of negative experiences leading up to it. So it kind of changed my pedagogy and made me a lot more patient. I found that I needed to listen a lot more. I think maybe because, as you probably noticed already, I can just go on and on and on. And because I think that I'm being interesting, I can just steamroll at any dissent. I came to quickly realize that, my role in those spaces was very often to ask the good questions and then to monitor the quality of the responses, let the kids respond to each other. I know there's loads of like Twittery debate about this now about, the role of the teacher should be the one up at the front. I've seen previous guests on the show who would be the antithesis maybe of my own pedagogy. But I increasingly found that by doing the online teaching, I was becoming more aware of the students' own responses and became better able to build up those kids who maybe in a classroom normally would sit there very quietly. They're thinking about it, they're absorbing it, but they're not building towards giving their own response. As schools opened then back up, I made quite a few changes in the way that I teach. I found that I was more patient, that I was more relaxed. There was something of the spirit of like, teaching is a thing that I can do whilst I'm sitting in my shed. I'm calm there. I don't need to be like happy clappy, up at the front, like high energy, whiz, 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 whiz with everything. You can still have that kind of warmth and rapport in the way that it's chilled out. And you can use that as a really good, safe context for learning in the classroom as well as in these online spaces with kids who've maybe brought, a lot of burdensome experience with them. I've been surprised at how much you can build genuine connection. And the mad thing now is some of the students that I first started working with in February 2021 are still with me now. And, you don't really get that as a primary school teacher. You're still in a community, so you see what happens, but you don't have that same I am your teacher relationship usually for more than a year. So it's been fascinating going through lockdown, going through coming back out with these students. Yeah, it's been very, very interesting.
Yeah, I really connect with what you're saying around the tweaks that you might have to make if you're working online, but also some of the benefits that can be achieved. And I was really interested by the cycle of online influencing in-person working. And it made me think about a cycle that you mentioned at the beginning between your teaching and your writing. And I suppose I know a few different teachers who write, and it does seem like a really interesting dynamic. And I wonder what your thoughts were about how the two have influenced each of the different disciplines.
My recent teaching has definitely shaped my writing, like in the most explicit sense. As I'm working through my drafts, I've got kids in person but kids online who I can be like, can I just read this paragraph to you, and like bring them into the whole process. And I think there's a huge benefit, for them as part of their own development as writers to see that, again, sometimes in school, writing is framed as being about the product. Like, good writing is the thing that is done rather than the thing that you are doing. It's the product more than the process. So I think by bringing my teacher identity and my writer identity together, I think it enriches the two of them, and it's enabled me to teach writing more effectively as well, you know, as well as improving my own writing. For me, it's clarity. You can probably see that if you had to transcribe the sentence that I just said, which was like, you know, a pebble dashing of commas. I don't instinctively speak in a clear way, but by having to create learning materials that would work online, speaking to kids who maybe don't have English as a first language and are quite early in language acquisition, all of these very broad pedagogical experiences I've got as a teacher in, you know, East London primary schools teaching mythology, as well as teaching kids like sort of ages 8 to 13 with the whole breadth of like experience that you might have at that age. It's just meant that clarity has become much more important in my teaching. And as I move towards writing, it's helped because I've got like an absolute, you know, graveyard of notebooks in the room over there of like all of these writing projects that I've done, which at the time the writing felt really good. I felt like I was being, you know, I don't know, you know, like Will Self writes in that very like long, detailed, meandering, but still somehow interesting sort of way. That I thought that I was doing that and I'm not. So I'm learning that like being precise, being concise in teaching and in writing is very beneficial for me as a writer, but also for anyone who is listening and for anyone who is reading. Clarity has been the thing.
Clarity. That word's really stood out to me, clarity and concision. Sadly, speaking personally, I only really connected with writing as a process in my mid-30s. And before that, I really did feel like it was about the end product. And now I think of it as a thinking process, which is, you know, so much more liberating and useful. And it's really lovely that you're able to model that to children, because I really wish that I had teachers at any stage during my educational journey, you know, like from primary school through to doctoral level, I've had people who didn't tell me how to write better, but told me that my writing wasn't what they wanted. And it was just such an interesting and conflicting experience. And
it's a very hard one to teach, isn't it, writing? Like, there's so many aspects to what constitutes writing. It is objectively a difficult thing to teach because it's so, you know, fractured and multi-layered.
Yeah, I really can see how the Greek seminar style format might be quite conducive, though, because you can actually ask people what they were trying to communicate or what they were thinking or how they were feeling when they were writing. And then you can, you know, really quickly start to pick apart the kernels in there. This is a bit of a segue, but I'd hate myself for not asking. Is it just about Greek myth for you, or are you kind of finding yourself, segueing or moving into other kind of mythology bases?
Yeah, like I'm segueing. So I'm very keen that I don't want to teach beyond the level that I can answer children's questions well. So I'm very keen to always do a lot of good reading. And with mythology as well, there's definitely aspects of it's, these are not my stories to tell, you know, so there are some aspects of mythology. Say if it was, a lot of my students are based in the US, like I would say the majority, it's maybe 70% of them are in the US. And several of them, they're like, right, we've finished all the Greek mythology, like do some of ours, like do Native American mythology. And it's, these are not my stories to tell, and there are better teachers, some of whom are from these different traditions, to tell these stories. But, you know, for me, bearing both of these things in mind, I'm enjoying at the moment going into like Norse mythology. You know, like I don't want to like make the connection that just because my beard is slightly ginger that I'm like claiming some sort of like Nordic ancestry. But if I am going to do that, I think I've got Nordic ancestry. So I'm sort of there's something that feels very like of the earth and very Yorkshire-ish to me about Norse mythology, especially like I'm reading a lot of Kevin Crossley Holland, who's this phenomenal, you know, a phenomenal writer, children's writer, but also a, you know, a translator of, you know, translated from Icelandic into English, lots of the Norse stuff. So I'm enjoying tiptoeing away from the Greek myths into that. And yeah, I'm starting to look at like local folk tales, like Yorkshire folk tales and like British folk tales. I heard recently about someone called like Jenny Greenteeth, which was like a kind of warning story in Yorkshire somewhere, where it was like a story that was, if a child strays too close to the stream, this like hideous thing will emerge out and like grab them in, called Jenny Greenteeth. And there's a similar one which is in Lancashire as well. The reason I mention it, I don't want to associate myself too much with Jenny Greenteeth, but just seeing that the more I'm learning about different mythologies, the more I'm seeing these deep connections between all of them. Like the most recent course that I've done, and obviously then the reading going with it, has been like a comparative mythology course for 9 to 13 year olds, all about tricksters, like trickster mythologies. And that really has been interesting. You know, it's my pedagogy has changed, because I do feel much more confident in handling quite challenging, deep, introspective conversations with groups of kids. And I'm finding they've happened a lot through talking about the idea of tricksters and, you know, like shape-shifting. What does it mean to be a trickster in mythology, and what can the kids learn from the stories of the tricksters? Do you need to be a trickster to bring trickster energy into what you do?
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I don't know. It's a weird little world. I'm very grateful that this is the kind of odd stuff that I do for work. Like, I know so many people, like so many people in my own family, who have to work so, so hard, and they don't get this kind of creative freedom that they would want. You know, they don't get the reward for the efforts that they put in. So something about doing this with the Weird Trickster course has like really made me think, like, what a privilege that my job is to talk about Renard the Fox with kids from, you know, Alabama and South Korea. And, you know, like, just it's a really, really weird pivot that this is what I'm doing with my life, is talking about trickster myths with the world's children from my garden shed.
But I love the fact that a course on the trickster might help you reflect on your own identity and history, and that seems quite fitting, really. And maybe the last question I'd like to ask is just about my perception of the types of thinkers or myths that seem to be most prevalent in England and America. This is mostly based upon my reading of tweets from tech bros. So, you know, very limited research done, but it all seems to be Greeks and Romans. And there seem to be some great quotes out there, and really interesting philosophies and thinkers. But yeah, I do wonder why, and again, maybe you'll disagree with my take, but my perception is that in the UK, at least, we do gravitate to the Greek and Roman thought from that particular time period, and don't have so much connection with Jenny Greenteeth or, you know, whoever it is, these kind of more localized and culturally specific myths or bits of thought. So yeah, I wonder what your take is on that, and how you kind of square that with your own practice and the types of areas that you choose to focus on.
Yeah, it's one that I definitely think about, and I don't feel like my ideas on it are super clear. That I feel like there's definitely something around cultural capital and the idea that like Greek and Roman mythology has typically been associated with an elite/elitist education. So it has that kind of validation and backing behind it. Those kind of books and those kind of collections then have always been, you know, published. They're the ones that are accessible. Whereas it's interesting when you look at kind of British, like say British myths, like folk tales, they often become very associated with the kind of like pagan tradition, and that kind of paganism, etc., is looked down on as being like hippy dippy and things. It might be that there's very similar stories and conventions, and even like the archetypes and the forms themselves might be very easily comparable with Greek myths, Roman myths. But something about the perception of them is that they are, you know, like pre-Enlightenment tales. Like they're perceived very differently, I feel. I don't know, people's connection with, it's a weird one. Like the other work that I do is to do with nature and to like take kids out into nature and do like poetry retreats with my kind of friend and poet, Odissa. So we talk about nature a lot too, but there's that sense here that to have an interest in nature, like so many of these myths are very nature grounded and forest set. It feels a little bit, I don't even know what word to use. You know, it feels like hippie-ish. It feels like a retreat from the confines of academic knowledge and culture that are esteemed, which I think is a huge shame. And yeah, like I say, my views on it are not clear, so there'll be nothing there which can be turned into a gif over a sunset. But yeah, there's more to think about with it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I love that, you know, that's the aspiration. sunset gifts. Well, thank you. Yeah, I feel like there's so much in this topic around the types of knowledge which we regard to be important, the ways that we think we should be teaching, and indeed the types of people that have access to types of knowledge. I'm curious, maybe it's not curiosity, I'm keen for you to share, where can people find you if they're interested in knowing more about your work, or maybe even participating? Also, brackets, do you ever work with adults?
No, I don't, but I increasingly, people are asking, like often the parents of the kids that I'm teaching are like, I was just like, you know, making lasagna and I couldn't help but hear your conversation. It sounded interesting. No, at the moment I don't. And again, it's that whole idea of somehow when it comes to like teaching it to adults, my barrier would be, I would feel like I need to be a specialist in classics. And I don't know how true it is. Maybe it's just a barrier in my own mind. You know, the way that I teach it with the children, I don't feel like I'm doing a disservice to the classics educators by not having that as my background. I think, you know, if anything, my background in social anthropology and social sciences is how I've approached the myths, you know, like looking at them as literary, cultural things and then sharing it in that sort of spirit. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I should, I don't know. But for anyone who wants to know more, so, I mean, Twitter might not be a thing by the time this is released, but if it is, it's at @JohnnyWalker_edu. And then on Instagram and Threads, which does exist now, that would be @OtherwiseEdu. So Otherwise Education is my organization through which I do a lot of my work in schools. So if you just search for that, that would be the way. Not to be confused with Education Otherwise, which I didn't realize existed when I made the name of my own thing. So yes, Otherwise Education.
Yeah, similarly named people and organizations out there. I just love the image that you've left me with, which is of parents finding excuses to do chores and activities at the same time as your session, just so they can kind of just absorb these myths and wonderful teachings.
Yeah, I often find I'm like firing jokes over the kids' shoulders over Zoom.
You've been listening to the Sizzle podcast, and if you enjoyed today's episode, the best thing you can do to help is to subscribe to the Substack, and that way you'll get all new episodes straight to your email, and you'll be first up for articles, resources, and lots of other goodies. And also to share it, you know, send the podcast to people that you think might enjoy it. Catch you next time on the Sizzle Podcast.